April 20th, 2005. For the record, present are Representatives Cartula, McGuire, Rookwood, Coghill, Berkowitz, and Coring. We have a quorum to do business. On today's calendar are HB 123, Occupations, Fees, and Extension of Boards. HB 121, Service Areas for Second Class Boroughs. And HB 98, Non-Union Public Employee Salary and Benefits. I'd like to dispatch for these first two bills as quickly as possible. And with that, we'd open the public hearing on HB 123 and ask the Director Urien of the Division of Occupational Licensing to come forward. And before we do that, we should adopt the CS Representative Coghill.
The X version?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we'd have the CS for House Bill 123, the X version under Michelle 1805.
I'd object, and I'd like to know the difference between this and the finance version.
Well, why don't we just let Director Urien give his testimony under your objection. I'll allow that to stand so he can explain what occurred, and then that hopefully will clear that up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Urien. I'm the Director of Division of Occupational Licensing. Appreciate the opportunity to be here before you today and correct the matter that was done in a different committee. As you know, the legislature has directed us to manage occupations. Whatever it costs us to regulate occupations is what we charge them, fee. And one of the biggest costs in managing professions is disciplinary actions. And for years, since the beginning of time, they took the fines that were generated and disciplinary actions, and it went into the mix. And then someone read the law, and the law says fees, and there's no mention of fines. So this section of the bill before you correct that inequity, and it's a matter of fairness. It's the professions pay a lot of money for the disciplinary actions, and what fines are generated by those actions will help offset some of those costs. It is not a money-making operation. It costs a lot more for the legal fees that we and all the disciplinary actions than we ever generate in fines, but it does help offset some of those costs. And that's all the language in sections 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's all it does. It lets us take the fines and put them into the mix for the professions and help offset their costs.
Yeah, if I might interject, the reason for the CS and the difference between the Labor and Commerce versions, which the director was acting under, what happened is the fines and penalties went to the general fund. They didn't return to the occupation. And that was the direction the legislature had given the director when he introduced the bill last year. We believed in, from an equity standpoint, that the fines, for example, which the cost of the proceedings are charged against the licensees, but they don't even benefit from any of the fines collected from those proceedings. So, but then when it reached the Finance Committee, there was a drafting technicality, if you will, where the bill before the Finance Committee allocated all the fines to the board and not the specific occupational license. And there are several boards that have several licenses that are calculated differently. So what the CS does, it specifically directs the fines to the particular occupational license, not necessarily the board or commission. It's just an accounting methodology.
And that was a section, Mr. Chairman? Was that a section directly, or is that
throughout? It's throughout the bill, with the exception of of the sunset. Representative Berkowitz.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm reading the finance version, and I don't see any mention of fines or penalties in there. It seems
well, it's together with, on section one, this is together with, Oh, that's right. The finance did take that section out because they were concerned that it didn't allocate the fines to the occupation, but just the boards. So their fix was to just excise the entire provision. Then it came to the chairman's attention that we needed to correct that situation. That's why the bill is before us. And I've talked to the people in the Finance Committee that dealt with it, and they're in concurrence with this. I mean, we had, I think, general understanding that this is the way that was intended, and I think that it reflects their views also. So,
Mr. Chair, no one's spoken to me about this. which is, seems to be a pattern with this administration, which they do at their own prerogative and peril.
No.
Let me, if I could just continue. It's my understanding that the Finance Committee stripped these provisions because they thought they should be in a different bill, that, and as a policy call, we shouldn't be conjoining these two in one package. And I am inclined to support that line of reasoning.
Well, Representative Berkowitz, if I might interject, there, that was part of their stated rationale. But in terms of the policy on the balance of it, they're in concurrence with this. The, your point is, you know, maybe argued and has certain validity as to whether or not it's appropriate to put these number of sunsets in with these other policy matters. That's a different issue. Yeah. But I would say this, this basically, this particular provision is a creature of the legislature, not the administration. So I don't think your intemperate remarks regarding the administration are entirely fair. Because this, clearly is a creature of the legislature.
I think I've been more than charitable with this administration, Mr. Chair. But if I could continue, too. There's also another problem. You know, from a policy perspective, if we're allowing the departments or the to collect fines and penalties in order to make up shortfalls instead of having them go into the general fund, there'd be an incentive for them to increase fines and penalties. Perhaps that would be disproportionate to whatever sanction they're being levied against. And so you don't want to make fines and penalties a fundraising mechanism for anybody. It's just, it seems like a bad policy call. What will happen is that fines and penalties will, in essence, become a way of taxing wrongdoers in order to make up budgetary shortfalls. And I think that's a bad policy call because you're not meeting out justice. You're just trying to get money.
Director, you want to feel that?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I think our total fines last year was $64,000. We license about 50,000 professionals, and if you divide 50,000 into 64, it's not a very big money-making operation. It cost of these disciplinary actions far exceeds any fines that we collect, and it is not a money-making operation. I think we went through that last year when we tried this. It was suggested it was sort of a conflict, but it is not.
If I could, Mr. Chair, that's my point exactly. It's not a money-making operation now, but if you incentivize it for the department to make it a money-making operation, I think it becomes more of a money-making operation. I don't know how that impacts the justice that these licensing boards are supposed to be doling out.
Representative Aaron.
The legislature sets the fines. We don't set the fines. They're set by statute.
Mr. Director, aren't there caps on some of them?
There are caps. We're not raising these up for anybody's benefit. It's not a possibility.
And
the system, the way the system is set up, it is not ever going to generate. You're not going to get board members. You have to have, number one, you have to have the complaints. You have to have somebody doing something bad. You have somebody file a complaint. And not going to be filing complaints against people that aren't doing something wrong, and you have to go through the judiciary process to establish the fine.
Richard Berkowitz.
You also have, but it's fines and penalties. And I don't know whether penalty, for example, a penalty I would imagine could be if someone's overcharged in a certain profession, the penalty would be that they'd have to pay it back. Now, I don't know what that is, but it doesn't say fines. It says fines and penalties. And then the second question I'd have would be, does this run afoul of the dedicated funds provision of the Constitution?
In answer to that, I think penalties in the main are late fees and things of that nature. Fines are meted out by the process where there's a hearing officer that acts independently under the testimony and then makes recommendations to the Board of the Commission for the final meting out of the sanction. So there is a check and balance on the process there. And as to constitutionality of a dedicated fund, we're not creating a fund, we're just directing a fine to an appropriate area. So I don't even think that comes close.
We're taking funds that would otherwise go to the general fund and then be dispersed through the normal budgetary process and handed in directly to the department.
I can't answer the question on the constitutionality of it.
Representative McGuire.
Well, We do have some precedent for that. For example, we direct some of the penalties that come from criminal activities to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. And I'm just trying to think about how we do that and if it's similar. I can't think off the top of my head, but I know there is some precedent for it.
Let me just interject. We put the funding rudders on bill after bill after bill to direct fines there. And we can, Ms. Davidson can elucidate on that.
Still
if
have
you
to
like.
Be appropriated, I think, is the
fundamental
point.
Right, they do have
point.
To be appropriated.
So even though this is more of a statement of our intent about where we think philosophically the money should go, but there still has to be an appropriation on the part of the legislature. So.
Patsy, do you want to come on up and help us out a little bit?
For the record, my name is Pat Davidson with the Division of Legislative Audit. With regard to the fines, what's set in statute is how the fees for the occupations are set, and they're set using the calculation of the regulation has to be offset by the fines and possibly the fines and the penalties under this legislation. So in statute, you're not appropriating the money, you're not dedicating the money, you're just setting forth the calculation by which the fees for licensure are going to be set by occupation. It still does have to be appropriated.
Some Cartula.
Thanks. Well, they're program receipts, right? So they're set for separately, and they're appropriated, but it does set up a situation where those receipts are basically set aside in our mind for these programs, and that the appropriations, the statute says, are not made from the unrestricted general fund. So you're sort of setting up that situation, and at least in my way of thinking, you always kind of look at those funds to see how much you're going to get out for the specific programs, more or less.
No. Through the chair, Representative Cotula, I think you're right. In a lot of people's minds, and when you talk to the licensees, they believe it's their money. But there is, because of the prohibition against dedicated funds, it isn't. What you've done is you've set up a mechanism for calculations. They're being tracked in a certain way so that amount then can go into the budgetary process, be identified as those program receipts, and move forward.
Any further questions, Ms. Davidson? Thank you. Is there any further testimony from anybody who wishes to testify on House Bill 123?
I have one question to Mr. Urien.
Certainly.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cartula, Director Urien.
Thanks. It's Section 14 of the CS, and this is probably picky, and I could have called you, but I just wasn't thinking about it before committee. It's the, I think it's the social workers that there was a repealer for. Just repeals the section that says that all the persons licensed under the chapter are considered to be engaged in the same occupation, and I just didn't know what it did. It's section 14 on page 4 of the CS. You know what that's about?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. That's one that I hadn't noticed before.
Where was it again? Okay. Yeah.
There's a repealer on page 4. It's section 14. It's at line 25 of the CS. I just didn't know why it was there. That was all. I don't know if there's some specific reason for it or a case or something and why we're repealing it. I know what the underlying statute says, and maybe there's some reason for not saying they're all part of
the... Well, I'm looking back here. Let's see. Let's take a brief at ease. See if we can sort this out. There's a draft. It was omitted in drafting. It was a drafting error or whatever. We just want to add it back in. And for explanation, I've asked the representative of these folks to come forward. Mr. Walsh, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Walsh. I'm a lobbyist registered with the Alaska Psychological Association here. And we our sunset renewal is in the bill, and we appreciate your consideration, and it has passed through the audit, and the recommendations are to extend it. And the other issue that we asked for at the time that the bill was in the Finance Committee was the and they accepted our amendment, was to allow for another provision for licensing by credential. The current statute allows, besides the doctoral requirements, a good standing status with the American Board of Professional Psychology, and evidently as these boards or national associations grow, or even international, they have different referencing credential boards that they would like to then be able to refer to in statute in order to accept a candidate that might come into Alaska with those credentials. So we think this is modernizing the statute to reflect what's occurring nationally. Just for the record, though, there is not a lot of traffic in and out of Alaska for the psychologists. It's fairly a stable market, if you will. So with that, I appreciate you reinserting that back into the rules version.
Hey, Mr. Walt, any questions to witness?
I'm to understand that it was officially amended into the finance bill.
That's correct.
So,
and when we were redoing it, it was inadvertently amended. So we'll accept that.
Thank you.
So, Representative Cockfield, if you make a motion to...
Yes, I would... I guess that would be a conceptual motion.
Right.
We take the Section 7 from the House Finance version, which is I, and insert it into the draft that I, at this point, have an objection to, which is the X version for CS House Bill 123.
Is there any objections to the conceptual amendment number 1, adopting Section 7 of Finance? Seeing none, so ordered. The
Mr.
Representative Berkowitz.
I think that motion is out of order because there's a pending motion on the floor.
To accept the CS or not.
Right. I noted there was an objection.
Oh, that's correct. My mistake. Thank you for pointing that out. Therefore, you're withdrawing the amendment, and there is a motion to adopt the CS. Is the motion maintained to adopting the CS?
The objection is maintained.
That's maintained, and therefore, in order to adopt the CS, we'll have to have a vote on the roll call, please. Would the clerk please call out the roll?
Representative Petula?
No.
Representative Harris, not present. Representative Cockhill?
Yes.
Representative Corey?
Yes.
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Representative Berkowitz?
No.
Chair Roper?
Yes. We have before us the X version. Representative Cockfield.
All right. Now, Mr. Chairman, I would move conceptual amendment 1, which would take the Section 7 from the House Finance version I and insert it in the CS draft X that we adopted.
Any objection to the conceptual amendment number 1? Seeing none, the conceptual amendment number 1 is adopted. And we have the bill before us as amended. What's the will of the committee?
I have some questions about the bill. It's unusual to me to see all of these professions rolled into one bill against what our statutes say. I know there's an exemption, but could I ask Ms. Davidson if this is done very often? I mean, I was just surprised to see them all into one bill.
Certainly, you may ask.
Is it unusual, or is this just something that I haven't seen before? Thank you.
For the record, Pat Davidson with Legislative Audit. Through the chair, Representative Cutula, yes, it is unusual. However, you're going to probably see a couple bills doing this because we have a very unusual amount of sunset boards and commissions going through this session. Where typically the legislature will see 3 or 4, there's 12 current ones plus 2 holdovers from the prior year. So you have an extraordinary number of boards and commissions going through the sunset process this year. But I would agree that it is not at all typical that you see them combined.
Representative Cartula.
It just worries me that we're going against what the statutory policy is. And if we don't think that's the right policy, we should probably change the underlying statute. But
what statute are you referring to?
The one that says that you can't mix the boards together in these sunset bills, that you have to take them all separately.
What's that?
I think that you had this concern in a previous committee, actually.
Sure, it's in Section 8, it yeah. talks about we're exempting ourselves from 44, 60,
right.
and 50.
Mr. Chairman, to address that point just a
Ms.
little
Davidson.
Bit. Excuse me. One of the things that when we were looking at recommendations for extensions, recognizing how difficult it is for the legislature to deal with this many bills, we set the years to provide a smoothing in the future to get back to a point where the legislature is only going to be looking at 4, 5, possibly 6. And that's one of the reasons that some of these boards are extended for 6 years, some for 5 years, and some for 4 years, when the current statute recommends a normal four-year extension.
That's why the terms are, the years are staggered in this particular
yes.
bill. And, Mr. Davidson, do you know what the cost of, to the legislature in the state of Alaska is to have a just one individual sunset bill? Any idea?
Mr. Chairman, while I would be familiar with the cost of the audit, I don't know about the process of getting a bill through the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions of Ms. Davidson?
No. Thank you.
Pam, would you come up? I'll direct the question I just asked Ms. Davidson. Do you have any idea what it costs the legislature to introduce a bill, for example, a simple sunset bill?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any idea. I don't even know how you would go about calculating it. One bill has got to be somewhat less expensive than a lot of smaller bills, just because of the amount of committee time that is taken up with each small bill.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Barney, would you venture a guess, or do you have any idea? No? I won't ask you then. Just for the record, my opinion is it costs a lot. Uh-huh. And by doing six, it costs less.
I think the minority deserves kudos for not moving too many bills, Mr. Chair.
However, yeah, amendments cost money, too.
But they inspire thought.
We appreciate this. Is there any further discussion of this bill? Representative Cartula.
I'm going to accept that we've mixed together for the purposes of getting us through this session, but, you know, it's a bad idea. Each profession has its own particular needs, and by doing it, I think you kind of sell the professions a little bit short. I mean, often in the sunset hearings, you'll get to get into the meat of what's going on, and it helps us understand them and do a better job by them. So, but I understand. Thank you.
And well, I think in defense of the Labor and Commerce Committee, I think the intention here is they did vet all the audits and see whether there's any minimal contentions. And with the exception of the psychologists that came up later, there was no major requirements that we were aware of, I think, at the time, as I recall the testimony. But I might be mistaken, but, I mean, there was, in the main, there was not a lot of controversy. So that was the intention there. The other bills that did generate more interest and were handled or were handled separately.
Thank you.
And that was just the rationale. With that, Representative Coghill.
Then I would move that we pass out of committee the CS for House Bill 123, X version as amended, with individual recommendations and
fiscal notes or notes?
Fiscal notes.
Is there any objection to doing so? Seeing none, so ordered. Thank you very much. Next, we'd like to take up our favorite bill, House Bill 121. This is the service areas for second-class boroughs. And with that, I would ask there's a
pending motion
before us. Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would withdraw the amendment number one that was pending before we left, and we have a CS that will have the language in it. So at this point, I think I would withdraw amendment number one.
Okay, any objection to withdrawing amendment number one? Seeing none, thank you very much. And Representative Coghill.
In order to get to where I want to go to the CS, I'll have to rescind, I'd make a motion that we rescind our action in adopting work draft 24LS0615I. Michelle, it is 4605.
Motion before us to rescind our action in adopting the I version. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Coghill. We are now back to the CRA version. Therefore, we have, I believe there's a new CS. Representative Coghill. Yes.
I want to drop the, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would ask that we adopt the new work draft, which was LS0396/S as a working document, which is should be on the top working page.
Now that everybody's thoroughly confused, are there any objections to adopting version S? Seeing none, so adopted. Does anybody want to clarify this as to what we're doing here?
I would ask that we'd have Ms. Anderson come up and help us wade through this, but what we're doing is adopting
essentially
amendment language that I was trying to get to.
Right. Ms. Anderson.
I'm Linda Anderson, representing the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and the CS that you have before you, S version, is a compromise legislation tightening the sidebars on giving the a second-class borough the ability to consolidate or dissolve a road service area if they meet the criteria that's underlined on the second page in your draft. I believe most parties are satisfied with that approach, and it still remedies the problems that are facing the Fairbanks North Star Borough with our 109 service area dilemma. And I appreciate the committee's patience through this process. Third hearing is hopefully a charm, and that's all I have to add. Any questions I can answer?
Any questions of the witness? Seeing none, thank you very much. We do have available representatives of the department, I believe. Are they here? No. Did we run them off? And Ms. Cook is here for any legal questions. Anybody else wish to testify before on House Bill 121? Seeing none, we have the bill back before us. The chair would greatly like to get rid of this bill. He wishes to give it a bon voyage. So,
Chairman, I'd love to make that motion. Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence on my part. And I would move that we pass CS for House Bill number 21, the S version, dated 4805, out of committee with individual recommendations and... I don't know. There is an attached fiscal note.
I'm not going to object, but could I say something for the record, Mr. Chair?
Certainly. Representative Cartula.
Having, unfortunately, sunk into the service area issue once again, I really have a lot of empathy for the problem that Fairbanks faces, and having been approached by a certain member of our caucus to explain it a little bit better, I have even more. But I think the problem is the underlying statute, and until that gets fixed, you know, we're going to keep going in this circle. So I think eventually we'll have to take a step backward and go to that. But at this point, I think this is about as good as we can do. It's a mess from the beginning. So thank you.
Any further discussion or comments? In the interest of our open methodology here. Seeing none, there's being no objections before us, the bill is moved out of committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Next,
Chair.
I'd like to take up the House Bill 98. And just to explain to the committee, the reason I've calendared this bill is that I wanted to bring before the Legislature and the Rules Committee a discussion about the potentiality of any possible amendments to this bill, the impacts on the budgets, particularly the legislature, and I would like to discuss. There's no amendments prepared today. My intention today is not to move this bill. It's merely to bring it up and have invited discussion as to what the bill does, its impact on the non-covered employees, and the potentiality of looking at further amendments to that may impact the commissioners and the chief executives of the state. And additionally, review whether or not we should include legislators in this bill. There's been discussions of that degree. So I wanted to basically catalyze the discussion and move that along. With that, I'd like to have Mr. Tibbles. If you can come forward, just basically describe the bill and the circumstances that led the administration to introduce the legislation. Mr. Tibbles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mike Tibbles, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. Pleased to present House Bill 98 to the committee today. House Bill 98 matches the statutory pay schedule for partially exempt and exempt employees in legislative, judicial, and the executive branch of government, and provides the same wage adjustment that was recently negotiated with the supervisory unit in the Public Employees Association. We have a two-step process that's required to provide wage adjustments to our state employees, and one is through the collective bargaining process where we submit the monetary terms to the legislature, and that has been done and included in the House budget. We have a significant amount of increase this year in wage adjustments. Yes, Mr. Chairman. The collective bargaining process, we have submitted monetary terms last year and this year to the legislature, and so far in the process, those have been approved by in the budget. The second step to provide the wage adjustments to our state employees is to introduce legislation similar to what you have in front of you now that covers the partially exempt and exempt employees. And we feel this bill is really important for a number of reasons. The first reason is basic equity. Our statute requires us to pay our state employees like pay for like work. And the failure of the passage of this bill, we will see a 9% difference between the employees of a particular range under a collective bargaining agreement and in the statutory schedule. And that does cause us problems because we're not meeting that. I don't believe we'd be meeting our statutory obligation. But two, causes us some problems with we had just to give you an example where we were looking at moving a budget analyst from admin service division into OMB, or you could take the same example in with legislative affairs, and it would have been a pay cut for that individual to move to exact same step. So again, we will be looking at a 9% difference between the two statutory schedule and the collective bargaining contracts if the bill doesn't pass. Second concern that I have is an issue regarding just recruiting qualified managers. We're asking our managers to do more and more, and when we get to such a disparity between the contracts, I feel that we really place a heightened burden and challenge on our ability to hire qualified managers. And the third concern I have is that we have a difficult time getting people to move up into some of the senior management positions. You have supervisors of supervisors that are paid on a statutory schedule, and it doesn't take very long for the supervisor of the supervisor to make less than the people that they're supervising. And I've provided some charts that are in your packet. The last page gives you an example of that scenario I just mentioned, where you have a supervisor and a supervisor of the supervisor, or here we could use the example of a deputy director and a director. After 4 years without this wage adjustment to match up to the collective bargaining agreements, you'll have deputy directors making more than directors. And again, that, you know, not only with the competitive salary aspect of it, that equity issue, it just causes us hardship in getting people interested in moving up into the senior management. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Representative Berkowitz?
Just a comment. I hope it inspires a consistent application of this line of reasoning by the administration, the desire to recruit and retain, the desire to have competitive pay packages. I hope that you'll keep those thoughts in your mind as you review changes to the PERS-TERS system, because all of those issues are right there too. And I think we run the risk of being inconsistent when we're just taking care of the people we actually work with on a daily basis and ignoring the folks that are out on the roads and far from Juneau.
Any further questions of Mr. Tibbles? Well, I have some. You mentioned recruitment and advancement issues. How does this play out in terms of the senior commissioners themselves and the top executive layer of our government?
Mr. Chairman, the commissioners are a unique situation. Their statute is set at a particular range and step in the statute.
What is that?
A 28E.
28E. And what is that? What's that compensation level anyway?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's roughly 91.
91,000 a year.
Yeah. I can give you an example of, I mean, we have a real recent example of why this has been a problem. We had three acting commissioners recently, and the governor had appointed individuals to fill those positions. But if you go back and if you look at the applicant pool, a number of those applicants would have received a pay reduction to take that commissioner job, that top spot. So.
Precisely. In fact, I can't recall, it's anecdotal to me. We were talking about the vacancy in the Attorney General's office, and someone was talking to a relative who was a deputy city attorney at a small municipality in the Puget Sound area, and the deputy city attorney was making more than the AG was making in the state of Alaska. It's how extraordinary, you know, in terms of recruitment. And I hate to use the adage, you get what you pay for, but I think many people who take on the commissioner's roles give up a substantial amount of compensation for the honor and public service provided by that position of leadership. I think it's particularly striking in Alaska, where we have this bifurcated government. We have many people who live in the south central or interior of Alaska. They're called to do the act in public service in Juneau, as the legislature is, and end up having two homes or two residences, or have to maintain an abode, if you will, in two different communities, which puts a substantial burden on them and financially and their families. So, to say nothing of the commuting and various other activities of travel. So, I think it very much is inconsistent. We're making a substantial increase in the non-covered employees here. I think it's appropriate for this committee and the legislature to take this issue up. To say nothing of the governor and lieutenant governor. Mr. Tibbles, do you know what the governor makes in this state?
The governor and lieutenant governor's salary are established at a dollar amount in statute, and I believe the governor's 85.7 and lieutenant governor's 80,000.
85.7? What was that?
I believe the governor's salary is 85,700.
And the lieutenant governor's?
80,000.
80,000. So these elected positions are actually even getting less than their commissioners. That's very interesting. It's even hard to recruit good people to run for governor. You might make that case.
I take offense at that.
Is this your official announcement?
Right here.
I'm defending the current governor. That's
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Let's get this straight here.
Sure.
Okay.
Glad to see the members change of heart.
That's right. I appreciate that. Representative McGuire.
Mr. Chairman, I want to know your plan for amendments. I just want to let you know that I want to work with you, but I'd like to, this is the vehicle to do it, and I think we all need to work together, the judicial branch, the executive branch, and the legislative branch. Our legislative employees, I think, of particular note, have been left behind. And, you know, these are folks that do a lot of hard, good work for the state, and I just want to know, do you want to take this up with amendments at a later point in time? And
right, that's my intention. I want to take some
you?
Right.
Okay.
Some testimony today. We'll have Ms. Varney come up and Mr. Christensen also about their separate branches of government, and we can discuss those at that time. We have Mr. Tibbles here. I wanted to bring up this whole idea. I mean, my intention is not to change in any way the bill, is to add to it, frankly. That is my intention, and I wanted to have that debate, and I think we needed a public debate about whether the commissioners of the state and the administration need to be raised. As a matter of fact, I've had some discussions, and I believe that the Knowles administration had offered an amendment to the schedule for commissioners just as when they were transitioning out of office. And we'll be taking a look at that as a adjustment of the step level. It cuts off the F range and then goes up to a 30 and then allows the increase in the commissioners. And any debate about the governor, lieutenant governor, I think would be a stipulated amount. And I'll be circulating those amendments and even the list of what other states do as far as compensation of the governor, lieutenant governor, and other major offices that we've accumulated to allow the committee members and any other, any interested parties to take a look at these things and bring it back before the committee. We have to act relatively quickly here. We're also waiting to see what happens in the Senate. The Senate has a similar bill in the Senate Finance Committee right now. I want to let them know what we're doing here and having this discussion today if they want to even take that up. But I think this is the appropriate bill, appropriate time to even have this discussion before it goes any further. So I appreciate the input from the administration on this and from the committee members. I'd like to get your opinions on this and whether we want to pursue this. It seems obvious to me that we're in a very difficult recruitment position here, particularly in the leadership in the departments are not compensated as well. It's hard to get people to make that transition and to come into public service. I know it certainly affects legislators. So, Mr. Tribble, thank you very much. I'd ask Ms. Varney to come on up.
Well, actually, why don't I, excuse me, Representative Berkowitz. Representative Petula and I are going to have to go to a caucus very shortly.
Okay, well then let's have Ms. Varney come up real quickly, and then we'll get to Mr. Christensen. He's the least controversial of these folks. And thank you, because these folks have to leave right away. Could you explain
you,
what this
Chairman.
Bill does to the legislature, their staffs, and also what the situation is with legislators? And the fact is, I understand we're not even tied to the 10A anymore. We're being paid less than pages. Is that correct? For the record.
For the record, my name is Pam Varney. I'm executive director of the Legislative Affairs Agency. In the 80s and in the 90s, the executive branch received a raise, which legislative employees did not. Currently, legislative employees are roughly 5% behind their counterparts. This bill should be passed as a matter of fairness and to eliminate any suggestion that employees doing similar work are not paid equally. It's really long overdue. You want to retain the best and the brightest, and we've lost many employees to the executive branch because they can take a position and at the same range and step and receive more money. We have they can accept a position at a higher range and receive an additional 5% increase in pay. We need to stay on an even par and to retain attorneys, programmers, personnel assistants, and probably most important to each and every one of you are the staff that are working directly for you. It is interesting to note the drain of legislative assistants. In budgeting, I do not see the higher longevity steps that we used to have in the legislative branch. We also, over the years, have had difficulty in the rural areas in hiring our teleconference moderators, and that is because the private sector wages are high, and it is we have this trouble in competing with the private sector to attract people to come and work for us. It's also very difficult for our staff at the lower ranges to keep up with the cost of living. To give you some idea of the difference between the cost of living increases and our legislative pay increases, the CPIU increased from 1988 to 2003, which is a total of 15 years, a total of 41.4%. Legislative pay increased 14.72%. That's a difference of 26.68%. To give you some comparisons to other state legislatures on how their salaries have changed over the last 5 years, New Mexico has increased 14.5%, Louisiana 30%, Indiana 12.7%, Virginia 11.8%, Rhode Island 12.3%, and Alaska 5%. I also have Carla Schofield here, our deputy director, and she would like to talk about the fiscal impact. And before I do, just to let you know about legislator salaries, in 1991, the legislature took themselves from the actual salary schedule and froze their salaries at $24,012 a year. And that also was the same year where we did not receive our cost of living increase. And the legislature did not get any good press in doing this. They have not gotten the increases over the years, and this year the per diem rate did go down substantially. It does. Yes, I know. I'm sorry.
Put this on the record, though.
The Legislative Council does not set the per diem rate to have it go up and down. We're tied to the federal per diem rate, although Legislative Council can look at making some changes. That is before the committee tomorrow morning, so that when someone does make housing arrangements and looks at planning out, you know, paying for their mortgage back home and also what they're going to be paying in Juneau, it is before Legislative Council to look at setting that per diem rate at the same rate it is for the first day of session unless the rate goes up. I wanted to let you know that I did talk to the Coast Guard. We investigated as to the survey that this per diem committee with the Department of Defense gets the information from and how they decide how the rate is going to go up and down. And the local Coast Guard will be doing another survey. In looking at the survey that they did for 2003 and 2004, they had three hotels which were in the valley. They did not have any of the rates for downtown Juneau. So I'm hoping that with them looking at it again, that maybe the rate will go back up. So, but that's something that that is in the future. And if Carla could come up and talk about...
Pam, just before you that.
Okay.
In 91, we decoupled. Were we range 10A, the legislators, or what?
Mr. Chairman, yes. You were equivalent to a range 10A. It probably is down to like a range 8 now. So it is, you know, quite, there's been quite a difference over the years.
Okay. Well, if you could prepare for the committee some information on what, if we were even to... to recouple a 10A or even 15A or something, it would be interesting to see what the impacts would be to the legislative salaries in terms of their total situation, and even if you could prepare a like an Anchorage CPI situation, you know, comparatively as we've done for the other salaries. So. Appreciate that.
I'd be glad to do that, Mr. Chairman. And there is a fiscal note that we did prepare, but I'd like Carla to talk about
sure.
how we could take care of that.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just briefly like to say that we have a fiscal note here, and it's for $1.6 million, and that's our preferred way of funding this bill. But we think it is so important that this bill be passed and that we have parity for our legislative employees that will help our hiring situation immensely, that the legislature has in the last few years lapsed over $3 million each year. And if it were the will of the legislature and the people in charge of the money or the committees were in charge of the money were willing to redistribute or fund salaries from all of their components, the legislature as a whole could probably absorb this in FY06. And like I said, we prefer the fiscal note, but that is an option if funding is an issue because this bill is so important to the legislature. And that was what I wanted to say.
Thank you. And there is, just for the committee's information, other discussions have been going on about other adjustments, too. So that's one of the outstanding issues here, how we can best compensate our staffs, retain them, and reward them appropriately. And as far as I'm concerned, those discussions are not over. And we're looking forward to making some further adjustments as needed. So with that, Mr. Christian, you want to come forward and... give us a brief explanation of the situation in the judiciary, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. I'd like to begin by thanking Governor Murkowski for placing the court system employees in his legislation. First, a little background. We have approximately 733 permanent employees, 62 of whom are judges appointed by the governor, 39 are magistrates, and the rest are primarily clerical employees. We absorb less than 2% of the general fund operating budget, which makes us smaller than a number of individual departments in the executive branch. While we're small, more private citizens come through our doors every day than any other entity in government, other than perhaps the university. Most of these people are upset, they're angry, they're scared, they're going through the most traumatic experience of their life. These are the people our employees deal with every day. These people were involved in 150,000 new cases filed last year. Court employees work hard under very difficult circumstances. However, I've often heard from employees, from the lowest level to the highest level, that they're proud of what they do, that they think what they do matters, and most of them do it for a very low salary. Fully 70% of our employees are compensated at range 15 or below.
70%, is that what you said?
70%.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I just, 70% that 15 or below.
And that, when I say 70%, that's 70% of all employees, including the judicial officers. So it's a very huge percentage. Probably 85% of our clerical workers are range 15 or below. Low salaries result in a very high turnover rate. Our turnover rate is about 50% before 5 years have passed. In a number of places in rural Alaska, we have had, such as Kotzebue, we have had turnover rates of 100% in 1 year. Part of the problem there is that the salaries paid by the local native corporations and by the local boroughs have, in recent years, dramatically exceeded what the state is able to pay. A large percentage of my clerical workers have second jobs. Now, the legislature has historically given non-judicial court employees a cost of living adjustment that's equal to the COLA it has approved for union employees. I would point out that we are a non-union shop. I think we're the largest non-union shop in state government. The last time the legislature failed to give our employees the same COLA it gave the unions was in 1993, and shortly thereafter, our non-supervisory employees voted to join the IBEW. In 1996, the legislature gave both union and non-union employees in the court system a cost of living adjustment that restored parity with the salaries that had been approved for the union employees in the executive branch. The unionized court employees subsequently voted to decertify the IBEW as its bargaining representative. Workers organize for different reasons. For court employees, the main drivers simply seem to be equity in salary with other state employees who are doing similar work, as opposed to dissatisfaction with working conditions. Now, with respect to our judges, Mr. Chairman, in 1982, Alaska's judicial salaries were ranked first in the nation. Today, however, according to the National Center of State Courts, the salary of a Superior Court judge in Alaska ranks 49th once adjusted for cost of living, from number one to number 49 in a little over 20 years. Now, normally when we talk about states that are 49, we're talking about Mississippi or Arkansas. Here we're talking about Alaska. I know that over the last 9 years or so, Alaska's judges have received salary increases of substantially less than one-half the rate of inflation during that period of time. Now, unlike other state employees, judges do not get annual longevity increases. The salary of a new judge is identical to the salary of a judge with 15 years of experience. Thus, there is no longevity increase to help compensate for unfunded cost of living adjustments. In addition, the geographic differential received by judges is substantially less than the geographic differential received by other state employees. For example, in Barrow, a union employee will receive a 43% geographic differential. A non-union employee receives a 31.5% geographic differential. The local judge only gets a 17% differential. Not only that, but all other employees have their geographic differential calculated on their full salary. The judge's is only calculated on the first $40,000 of his or her salary. Now, what this means is that we now have longtime prosecutors and public defenders in rural Alaska who actually make substantially more than the local Superior Court judge, which is not what the system originally intended. Now, HB 98 would give the non-judicial employees of the court system a salary adjustment in 06 that would place their salary schedule approximately on par with the salary schedule approved by the legislature last year for the employees covered by the APEA. Even if they get this, employees will still have lost substantial ground to inflation in recent years. Judges will get a salary increase equal to the salary increase that HB 98 proposes for range 28E in the executive branch. There are statutes that say that a judge's salary increase is tied to the percentage increase that a range 28E gets. Now, I would note that the salary increase will vault judges from number 49 nationally to number 47. So we think we still have a problem, but this is certainly a positive start. We do think, Mr. Chairman, that this bill sends a message that the legislature values court employees as much as it values the union employees in the executive branch, and that it does not take their hard work for granted. I thank you for hearing the bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Any questions, Mr. Christensen? Do we have a copy of your testimony for the record?
I can provide that, sir.
We appreciate that. That'd be good, so we can go back and refer to some of the statistical analysis. Right. Thank you very much. Either Pam or Carla, do you want to come back up? Just maybe Pam, come on up, or both of you. I'm looking at the bill here, and I'm looking at the 10A. 10A is what we pay our pages. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It is a range 10A.
There's always been an assumption that they're the lowest paid employee in the building, but that's not true anymore.
Mr. Chairman, probably our janitors are a range 8, and
oh, no.
We are looking at in the budget raising them to a range 9. So range 9 is really our lowest pay. So if that goes through and you don't look at raising your salaries, you would be the lowest paid. Not really employees, but
you're 8. Yeah, it's 2,000. $38 a month on this new, if we adopted the new bill, after the increase, the 5% increase, it's a range 8 is $2,038 a month. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Is it right? Oh, okay. Plus 2, yeah. So, yeah, just for everybody's understanding, the way the bill is drafted, the bill has a schedule that reflects a 5% increase. Then in Section 2, we bump it automatically by 2% on July 1st. That's where the 7% comes in. So the schedule is a 5% only. So there'll be basically an immediate effective July 1, 2% increase. Just so you, and then there's a follow-up 2% in 06, just to understand. But you're right. So looking at the schedule, though, I mean, so we're and what are the janitors again, Pam? There,
Mr.
What?
Chairman, actually, if this bill gets passed, you'd be down probably to a range 7, because just
points.
Even taking the 2,038 is about 24,456, and that's not counting the 2% increase. So I'm sure you'd be down to a range 7 or a range 6.
Very interesting. But if we were to reattach ourselves, was historically before 91, was it at 10A that the legislators were set at?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It was a 10A. Although back in the 80s, it was, I believe, 46,800. It was, and the per diem then was not.
Right. If one knows the political history of Alaska, we recognize that there was a period where the legislature to try to adjust the salary, and the public rose up and struck down the miscreants and the dastardly people that did that, unelected a lot, and they reverted back to another system. So we I think all of us know, and it'd be interesting to see the legislative history of that, which we might want to look into, Janet, see where the bodies and the skeletons are all buried. And the actions of the public, and that's been one of the problems. So there's been a level of timidity in a way, or fear publicly that the people won't accept that anytime there's any mention of increase, that there's a hue and cry of the public. The legislators are overpaid. They're supposed to be citizen legislators, and when in fact they're not anymore, particularly if the House members have to run for election every 2 years. So at any rate, that's our problem. But there is a huge political issue here that we're going to have to deal with if we're, even if we raised our salary $1, whatever.
Representative Meyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, in conversations with folks in my district going door to door and in town meetings and so on over the last 4 years, at least the people I've talked to in my district recognize that there's an issue and frankly question my sanity, you know, on a regular basis. Why would you choose to do this? How do you make a living? How do you keep two households? My neighbors in particular, because they see my house sitting there, you know, and so on. And so, you know, there's always a risk that when you take on issues like this, that there will be some type of backlash from someone. But I think it's an education process, and I think it's something I personally am willing to take on. I think there are other members of the legislature that will, and I think you'll find a lot of support, a lot more support than maybe what you might think, particularly when the folks in your district see the kind of work that you do. And I know you and I and others spend a great deal of our time in the interim and obviously during the session working on their behalf. So those are just my thoughts.
Ms. Barney.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Also, just Alaska is so unique from other states. There are not other legislatures that move their legislators because so many state capitals and the states are so small that they can drive home at night. And so it does make it very unique here that the cost of living, the salary that is set right now for legislators is so low, considering the unique circumstances that you have, that you are so far away and have to keep two households, where other state legislators do not have to do that. So you need to keep that in mind also in looking at raising the salary so that it makes it so that, you know, we can attract people that do want to be able to maintain their family households and also have public service.
Thank you. I am curious about what happened in 1991, maybe, you know, janitor, if you folks have any institutional history about why there was decoupled in 91 from the 10A. And the
Mr. Chairman, might
one basis to recouple that. I don't know.
It was my understanding that it was taken out at that time and that we were not given the raises because the legislature was looking at cutting the budgets in the executive branch and the judicial branch, and they wanted to show how they were cutting the legislative branch, and that is why it happened at that time. And I believe that they felt that the legislature would get some good press showing how they had cut their budget, and we did not.
Well, by my calculations, if I'm correct, if we were to adopt a 10A schedule of our pages, there would be approximately a $4,500 a year increase in the legislative salary. Then the issue becomes, can we handle the heat politically at $4,500, and is it worth pursuing? So that's the kind of feedback I like from the committee. And actually, might be a little more because you're right. The 2% comes on top of that. So.
Representative McGuire. Are you open to some analysis or discussion about other ranges as well?
Sure.
Because I think, first of all, I would say if you're going to take the heat, you might as well take it once and do it the right way. And I think there ought to be some analysis about what range we think the work that we do here is associated with. And I know there'll be differing opinions about it, but are you open to that discussion?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one reason I wanted to bring this up. I think it's appropriate. We're making a significant increase in making a commitment to our non-covered employees across the board and all branches of government. But I view there's two elements here that we're missing that I wanted to bring forward today. That was the senior leadership of the executive branch and the commissioners, particularly, and then we're adopting this to all the legislative staff, and frankly, the legislators themselves should be examined in the same context. So if everybody were rising, the ship is rising for everybody, we need to re-examine that, whether we pursue it or not. I think it's important we have the discussion, Representative Cockett.
I guess the issue to me in this bill is the equity with in-state workers and the marketability of our jobs. But that's not the issue with the legislature.
Right.
So, I mean, it may be with the legislative staff. And so I'm open to that discussion. But when it comes to talking about the legislators, I think that's a little different discussion. So the way I would look at it is, what's reasonable compensation for living expenses and for me? Because I still see us as a citizen legislator. And I understand. I mean, I've drawn summer per diem. I've done significant travel. In fact, I think I got whipped pretty good for traveling too much this year. But those things are reasonable for the job description, and that's defensible in my view. But as far as a base salary, I wouldn't want to look at it as a career step so much as a reasonable compensation. So those are the two different things that I'm going to be looking at.
Right. Well, there hasn't been any kind of adjustment for 14 years, and so I think it warrants at least an examination.
Yep.
And whatever the will of both bodies are about even pursuing the issue, we can talk about it and get the heat and see what the public thinks about it, and go from there and decide what to do. With that, the Rules Committee stands adjourned at 10:50. Thank you very much.